Before we begin this podcast, I'd like to tell you about a special deal. Subscribe today to The Spectator for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with, here's the magic bit, a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined by Coleman Hughes, who has been on the Americano podcast before, but is a rising star, I think, if I'm allowed to say such a ridiculous statement. But you are a rising star, Coleman. You are a writer, a musician in your spare time, I believe, and you have brought out this book, which is a big success. It's called The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. And, Coleman, one of the big themes in your book is neo-racism, as you call it. And I'd like you to start, you're probably bored of explaining this by now, but I'd like you to start by saying, what is neo-racism? Who are the neo-racists? And are they aware of the fact that they are neo-racists?
So neo-racism is a philosophy about how we should approach race and fighting racism. It essentially says that whiteness is bad, and anything but whiteness is morally superior. So if you're white, you're meant to be ashamed of that fact. You're meant to reflect on it with guilt and equate it with a kind of moral stain and ignorance about the world. And if you are non-white, you equate that with the opposite, with a kind of inherent moral superiority and deep wisdom. It also is a philosophy which advocates for racial discrimination against individuals in order to balance the scales of history and allegedly rectify racial inequity, which is how it would explain itself. The people who are neo-racists are, I go particularly after Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo in my book, only because they're the two most recent examples of mega best-selling authors who have promoted neo-racism and made those ideas spread. For DiAngelo's side, she's much more focused on the inner psychology of race. She wants white people to approach to reflect deeply on their whiteness, in quotation marks, and what that means. She prescribes a particular set of rules for when white people are talking to black people that they should follow when they don't, which they would not follow if they were talking to a fellow white person. For Kendi's part, he's not really interested in that. He's much more interested in public policy that racially discriminates until we reach this mythical end goal of equity, by which he means equal outcomes in proportion with the census, across the board, in every possible domain.
And I wonder, when you think about these neo-racists, do you think, like I think, because I'm white, do you think that they are just exploiting white guilt?
That's certainly the effect of it. Certainly their popularity is inseparable. It is a direct result of the amount of white guilt that exists. I mean, the people buying their book, in many cases, are buying their book in order to assuage a certain guilt that exists in America, in Canada, in the UK, in the West in general. It's a very interesting sociological fact about white Westerners that they do feel this kind of in the case of the UK, you could call it colonial guilt. In the case of America, you would probably just call it white guilt or guilt over slavery, for instance. the vast majority of peoples around the world who are trailing similar histories of injustice, of slaveholding ancestors, colonizing ancestors, which is most of us, feel no such guilt. So it's a unique fact about white Westerners that guilt exists in the first place.
And do you think there's an inexhaustible supply of this guilt, of white guilt, about that the neo-racists can play off effectively? I mean, I think about Tom Wolfe wrote Radical Chic and the Mau Mauing of the Flat Catchers. And that was, you know, how many years ago? Five decades ago. More, maybe. Mocking the way that, like, intelligent black grifters, essentially, take advantage of this, you know, terrible white guilt about racism and stuff to advance what, in the end, as you describe in your book, in the end, ends up being a racist agenda.
I don't think there's Tom Wolfe, that everyone should read that. It's been around for a long time. But no, I don't think there's an inexhaustible supply. I think that at some point, a person being exploited because of their white guilt also has, self-preservation instinct and self-interest. And a certain level of exploitation is going to bump up against a human being's natural tendency to want to preserve themselves. I don't mean preserve themselves racially. I literally mean preserve themselves as an individual, right? If you are, you know, I think in San Francisco a couple months ago, I saw a guy that was walking through the park asking white people to Venmo him for no reason, other than that he was black, Venmo him as reparations. It's like, okay, some number of white people will do that. Some number of people won't, but even the white people that will that are vulnerable to those sorts of manipulations, it will only go so far, right? They're not going to give you their house probably. Right. So there's, at some point it bumps up against legitimate self-interest and self-preservation.
Yes. And the moment it does is actually when it becomes threatening to people's comfort, I think. I mean, what I mean is white people will indulge their guilt to the extent that they're comfortable with it. But I think when they realize that it's threatening to them, then that might change. And a lot of people are now talking about, this happened with the Harvard president, Claudine Gay, at the beginning of this year. People started saying, you know, this might be the year where finally the DEI agenda runs out of steam. Douglas Murray in our magazine wrote a piece about your book, in which he said, you know, the time's up for racist anti-racism. Why do you think that might be the case? Why now is that happening, if it's happening?
I think it was probably triggered by the war in Israel. I think it was, you know, unfortunately, for the past few years, there have been people like myself, like the organization FIRE, people like Jonathan Haidt, Steven Pinker, John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry, Sam Harris, Andrew Sullivan, Christina Hoff Sommers. I can go on down the list. I'm missing many people, but who have been sounding the alarm about sort of DEI style philosophies infiltrating campuses, suppressing free speech, suppressing academic freedom, mostly targeting conservatives or even moderate positions on issues like race and gender, sexuality, trans, so forth. But there's a lot of liberals that just didn't care. There's a lot of liberals that would say, okay, yeah, campus has gone crazy a little bit. I half agree with you here, but why are you guys so focused on this issue? And so it was unable to, I think, make a significant dent. Certainly the donors to universities en masse didn't care enough for the universities to actually respond, because that's where it actually hurts them is, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of administrative incentives. So when the Israel war happened, and you essentially had immediately, before Israel had dropped a single bomb, you had people saying that Israel not Hamas was committing a genocide. You had professors, tenured professors, going out and celebrating Hamas's victory, saying that they were exhilarated. I think was the guy at Cornell. And then you had massive protests, against Israel, who had just been attacked. And then you had the college presidents going before Congress and giving an extremely legalistic and probably true defense of the free speech of pro-Palestinian activists. But this is in a context where they had literally all of these schools had spent years happily suppressing free speech on a million different issues. And then suddenly, when the speech is aimed at the destruction of Israel, all of a sudden they discover the virtues of unbridled free speech. So it was really it's not that their defense was wrong on the merits. It was actually right. It's just that it was utterly hypocritical given the past 10 years of speech policy on those campuses. And then when that happened, I think it triggered, there was like a type of liberal, some of them Jewish, and that's why they cared so much about the issue. But in general, there's a type of liberal that wouldn't have seen the problem 2 years ago, but as a result of that, began to see the problem. And then it just became a critical mass of people realizing that DEI it's not anti-racist. It is the source of race. It's the only source of racism on university campuses. There is still old white supremacy style white racism in other pockets of the country, but on universities and corporations, the only kind of racism is the DEI kind. So it's the opposite of what it says it is, and I think more people are now seeing that.
It's interesting that you mention the war in Gaza as a trigger for this. There was a clip of you on Joe Rogan that I saw a lot, and I've seen since. It's done an enormous number of views, where you sort of explain Israel's position in quite a, well, I'm not being a flatter, you do it very clearly and intelligently. You defend what was at that moment, I think, was sort of seen as an indefensible position. You know, nobody was at that time was saying, apart from sort of very obviously pro-Israeli voices, was saying that you know there is a moral justification to what's going on in Gaza from the Israel perspective. Or it's a legitimate action in some ways. Were you struck by the reaction to that clip of you?
Yeah, well, I think that a few things are going on. One is that Israel receives more scrutiny than any army has ever received, ever. Okay, including it probably receives more scrutiny by America than the American army does. I mean, there's just so. And the more light you shine on a military operation, the more warts you find, right? Because that is the nature of war, is that people make mistakes. People have to make split-second decisions based on limited information. Anyone who's, involved in high-stakes, violent situations understands this. So I think Israelis and people who support Israel feel... in particular, very, you could say, ganged up on by the international community. I mean, the fact that the UN has issued more resolutions against Israel than against all other member states combined, which include Iran, North Korea, Russia, Sudan, it's absolutely insane that the only democracy in the Middle East, where the only place where you could be a gay Muslim person holding your gay Muslim partner's hand openly, living openly, that's the place that has received the most human rights condemnations compared to any other country in the Middle East or the world. Okay, so Israelis feel like there's scrutiny on them, so I think they doubly or triply appreciate it when someone outside their community sees that and can understand it from their perspective. And then the second part of this is that a lot of people are seeing war for the first time because of TikTok, because of Instagram. A lot of people have actually never thought deeply, never studied deeply what other wars are like. This was a big deal during the Vietnam War as well, that people could see it on television. It very much changed their perspective, for the better in that case, because it was an unwinnable war and our leaders lied to us for years, knowing that it was unwinnable. But in this case, people are actually just seeing what the things that have always been endemic to wars for the first time, and they're having a human reaction to it. They're seeing collateral damage for the first time. They're seeing dead children for the first time. In reality, every single war we look back on in history that we know was a good war, including the U.S. Civil War that freed the slaves, including the Korean War, which prevented South Korea from being a communist hellhole for the past half century, including our effort to get ISIS out of Mosul. All of these wars, to say nothing of World War II, all of these wars had everything people are seeing in Gaza times 100, but people didn't see it. So we can think back on those wars as just wars, because we never had to have the emotional reaction of seeing the cost of war. Now, this is the first time we're seeing it. And so I feel my position is just consistent. I do believe war is sometimes necessary. I think history has proven that. And this war is necessary. And so just because I'm seeing the cost of it, I'm not going to suddenly change my moral position on whether a war is a just war. I think that's the inconsistent position.
Well, on that note, and I appreciate we're getting slightly away from your book, which I do want to talk about more, but I wondered if I could ask you about your reaction to what's going on with Candace Owens. And I don't think I'm just asking because she's black and you're black, at least I hope. That's not why I'm asking. But she is an interesting phenomenon, I think, that she's now fallen out with the Daily Wire, which was her employer, because she was being very critical of Israel, and she's now branded an anti-Semite. Do you think Candace Owens is an anti-Semite? I suppose that would be my question.
I don't waste my time by following her closely, and I never have. So I can't really comment specifically on, obviously what she said at Daily Wire, I think went far beyond criticism of Israel, if I recall.
Mm.
It was, you know, intimating that like a cabal of Jews control various sectors, like a gang, I think it was her analogy. The CIA invented Hollywood, and the timeline on that doesn't even make sense. But look, I don't, those clips could be out of context. Like I said, I don't really want to comment on that. I don't follow Candace Owens. I don't think she's worth following. I've never thought that. And to disagree with you, I don't think she's an interesting phenomenon. I think that she is someone who from the beginning will essentially say anything. She's not someone that seems at all constrained by facts. Like, she doesn't seem bothered when she just says something that's totally nuts. And the facts come her way. She's always seemed that way to me. And so I don't really see the difference between Candace Owens 4 years ago and the difference between her now. It always kind of struck me as insane that someone like would hire her. So I the reason she has a platform is because she's entertaining, and because it's because of everything beside the part of someone that cares about what's true and what's important. Everything else she has in spades, and that's why she's popular.
Yes, I suppose perhaps I'm undoubtedly more superficial than you, but I find that in itself is interesting, that success based off of that. But anyway, let's move on from Candace Owens. We've done that. I do want to play this clip, which we're going to play now. This was you on The View, and you were talking, you were on The View, which is, as British listeners might not know, it's a very, very big American TV show. Kind of Whoopi Goldberg and so on. And you went on there to talk about your book, and someone called Sonny Hostin took issue with you. And let's listen to that clip now.
When you say that socioeconomics picks out people in a better way than race, mm-hmm. when you do look at the socioeconomics, you see the huge disparity between white households and black households. You see the huge disparity between white households and Hispanic households. So your argument, and I've read your book twice because I wanted to give it a chance, your argument that race has no place in that equation is really fundamentally flawed, in my opinion.
Well, there's two separate questions. One is whether each racial group is socioeconomically the same. I agree with you, they're not. Of course, I agree with that fully. The question is, how do you address that in the way that actually targets poverty the best?
Great.
And what Martin Luther King wrote in his book, Why We Can't Wait, mm-hmm. is he called it, we need a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, we should address racial inequality. Yes, right. We should address the legacy of slavery. But the way to do that is on the basis of class. And that will disproportionately target blacks and Hispanics because they're disproportionately poor. But it will be doing so in a way that also helps the white poor, in a way that addresses poverty as the thing to be addressed.
That part is true, but as you are a student of Dr. King, I'm not only a student of Dr. King, I know his daughter, Bernice, right? Mm. So I'm going to get to my question.
Go ahead, go right ahead.
I think the premise is fundamentally flawed. You claim that color blindness was the goal of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. based upon Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, you know, content of character versus the color of skin. Bernice, Dr. King's daughter, points out that 4 years after giving that speech, actually, Dr. King also said this. A society that has done something special against the Negro for hundreds of years must now do something special for Negroes. He also said in 1968, it was about less than a week before he was assassinated, this country never stops to realize that they owe a people kept in slavery for 244 years. So rather than class, he did write about that earlier on, right before his death. He made the argument for racial equality and racial reparations. And so your argument for color blindness, I think, is something that the right has co-opted. And so many in the black community, if I'm being honest with you, because I want to be, believe that you are being used as a pawn by the right and that you're a charlatan of sorts.
He's not a Republican.
So how do you...
You've
said that you're a conservative.
No,
you did. You actually said that in a podcast that you did 2 weeks ago.
I said I was a conservative.
Yes, you did. So, but my question to you is, how do you respond to those critics?
Let's let him answer.
I think it's very important. The quote that you just pointed out about doing something special for the Negro. That's from the book, Why We Can't Wait, that I just mentioned.
Yes.
A couple paragraphs later, he lays out exactly what that something special was, and it was the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged, a broad class-based policy.
But he also says you must include race.
No, he didn't. He says it's
He does.
Okay, well, everyone should go read the book, Why We Can't Wait. Let's not get sidetracked by that. I don't think I've been co-opted by anyone. I've only voted twice, both for Democrats. Mm-hmm. Although I'm an independent, I would vote for a Republican, mm-hmm. probably a non-Trump Republican if they were compelling. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any evidence I've been co-opted by anyone, and I think that that's an ad hominem tactic people use to not address really the important conversations we're having here. And I think it's better, and it would be better for everyone if we stuck to the topics rather than make it about me.
I want to give you the opportunity to respond to the criticism.
I appreciate it. There's no evidence that I've been co-opted by anyone. I have an independent podcast. Mm-hmm. I work for CNN as an analyst. Mm-hmm. I write for the Free Press. I'm independent in all of these endeavors, and no one is paying me to say what I'm saying. I'm saying it because I feel it.
So, come on. I was very struck by that clip because I thought, firstly, congratulations to you for keeping your cool, because I thought she was unbelievably rude. And I think if anybody had been like that to me, I would have lost my temper. Can you just tell us a bit about how that happened and what it was like?
So I didn't know who Sonny Hostin was. I think that's probably a good thing, because I don't think anticipatory anxiety is really helpful in those sorts of situations. However, I was warned by the producer that Sonny was going to come after me, probably, and she was going to disagree with me. So I had some warning, but I've been in situations on shows like this where people warn me and it ends up being, you know, totally cordial. So anyway, you know, I got on there and she, I think that I had a good exchange with Whoopi Goldberg, with the others, but she had an angle and an agenda, which is, I think she wanted to, she wanted to paint me as someone that I wasn't. I don't think she knew much about me. And despite her having claimed to read my book twice, I don't think she read it even half once. Yeah. And so I think she had an image based on, you know, maybe talking to people or seeing a clip of me on social media that I was a Candace Owens type. And so she was talking to that kind of person. And then the person she met was actually someone quite different. And I think it was difficult for her to let go of the image of me as essentially an Uncle Tom or a co-opted, you know, like someone must be depositing Koch Brothers money into my bank account to get me to say what I'm saying. Couldn't possibly be that, you know, I've read a lot and thought a lot about these issues, and this is the conclusion I've come to. So I think, like I said, I let me put it this way. I think my, what people perceive as my ability to stay calm, it's just me, you know, I was listening to her. I actually wanted to see if she was making any points I hadn't heard before. And she didn't, but I wanted to give her the chance to do that, to actually respond to what she was saying.
Well, I thought the most extraordinary thing about that clip, in a way, was her just mentioning that she knows Martin Luther King's daughter, as though that somehow gave her some added insight, right. Which I thought was, it's sort of reflective of that type of thinking, that it's about, you know, who you know, whether you're part of a certain group rather than whether you're right or wrong.
Right. Yeah, total non sequitur. It's a total non sequitur that she felt comfortable. She felt, you know, increased her credibility. I mean, I think it speaks to her lack of intellectual substance.
Mm. And she didn't call you an Uncle Tom or an Oreo or anything like that, but that definitely was the sort of implication. You were a pawn of the right.
Yeah.
That you were being exploited somehow.
Right.
Which is actually neo-racist, would you not say?
In a way, yeah. I don't know. Someone told me that they thought it was classically racist, in the sense that it assumes that white people are powerful and smart enough to manipulate me, and that I'm too dumb and weak that I can't help but be manipulated.
Yes, you must be some kind of slave.
So actually,
if you're saying
someone was saying it struck them as like old-fashioned racist.
But to go back to the thesis of the book, if we are at this moment where people are beginning to agree with you, and people who normally wouldn't agree with you are now agreeing with you, and it's not just the conservative position to think this, that we need to be worried about, you know, neo-racism, that affirmative action is a euphemism, and that it's being destructive and so on. If we are reaching that position, is it going to take a long time for corporations and the government to change? Because it's, you know, you talk in your book about the American Rescue Plan and so on, and all the kind of essentially racist clauses within there. Perhaps you can explain to our listeners what they are. Governments and corporations are now enacting these agendas that have racial bias within them. So it's going to take a long time for that to change.
Yes. You know, I don't have the crystal ball. I don't know how it's all going to go down. I mean, there's so many changes that are simple in principle, but complicated in practice and in the sausage making of DC politics. And, you know, I don't really have the answers in those domains. I mean, there are things that, you know, that there are executive orders and Supreme Court decisions that could easily change a lot of government regulation around race. And it's a matter of whether there's the political will for it to happen. And then As for corporations, yeah, I mean, corporations are often they're big, they're slow, a lot of them are bureaucratic, and they have an inertia that makes it difficult for even a new CEO to change things. So yeah, absolutely. There's definitely an inertia and a hangover from wokeness that it may last a long time. But my hope is that I can be part of the beginning of change.
Yes. Well, I mean, a word you talk about in the book is equity, which is something we've discussed on this podcast before. And equity is quite a nebulous concept. And once it inserts itself into corporate thinking or government thinking, then it's very hard to remove, because it's like it's almost a sort of legal entity of its by itself now, equity, isn't it? It's something that you can't reverse once you implement it.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, equity is one of the most dangerous and wrong-headed ideas that neo-racism has produced. It is, it's akin to communism in its fundamental misdiagnosis of society, of human nature, and of where we should be headed. The fundamental problem is that we live in a multicultural society. Different groups have different cultures, different average ages, different geographical distributions, different demographics, different values, and different emphasized skill sets. And the history of multi-ethnic society and multi-ethnic, multicultural societies has been a history of disparities, many of which are benign. I define a benign disparity as one that's not caused by any kind of discrimination, but is the natural result of people pursuing what they want to pursue, and pursuing what they're good at. obviously, some disparities do result from discrimination, but the idea that you want to equalize society, it assumes that every single ethnic group, every single cultural group, however you want to define them, has basically a flat monoculture where everyone is taught to want the same things and taught to pursue the same careers and taught to value the same things to the same degree. Whereas nothing could be further from the truth, as discovered by cultural anthropology, sociology, actual studies of cultural differences, and so forth.
You talk about colorblind America as a kind of dream. It is a dream. It's something that you pursue. You think it should be pursued, even if it's never actually going to be achieved.
Yes. I mean, I view colorblindness similar to a colorblind society, similar to the concept of a peaceful society. We're never actually going to get to a perfectly peaceful society. There's never going to be zero murders. No one even expects that. But we understand that we're going backwards when the murder rate goes up. We're going forward when it goes down. So colorblindness is that kind of goal. It's not a goal that we're ever going to reach out and grab and have finally reached. But we should understand when we're going backwards, when we're going forwards.
I've often been struck when I look at stand-up comedy in the last sort of two decades, that a lot of it is about, if it's a black comedian, black stand-up comedian, a lot of it will be about race. A lot of it will be playing on kind of white thoughts about race and the identity of the comedian and so on. And I wonder whether, if we want to achieve a colorblind society, the fact that that's coming out through comedy is an expression of some kind of neurosis about race that we all have. And if we want to get to a colorblind society, we need to, or we want to try get closer to a colorblind society, we need to lose a lot of that neurosis and that sense of anxiety about it, which is all caught up in the way we're educated. What do you think about that?
That's a good point. I mean, I think, yeah, there's a lot of things that people can talk about. There's a lot of things that people can only joke about. Yeah. They can't talk about.
Yeah.
And I think comedy is a very healthy release valve for society in that way. I think more good comedy is almost always better. Being able to joke about more things. Though strangely enough, I think the whole censorious cancel culture age has weirdly been good for comedy, because the more things we're not allowed to talk about in public, the more funny certain jokes are. In a comedy club. So there's definitely a relationship between how free we are, like the topics we consider off limits in polite society, and the topics that are the funniest in a comedy club.
Yeah. So you think, in a way, suppression is good for comedy?
In a way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like in Soviet Russia or something, I suppose.
I'm sure all the famous Russian jokes about Soviet Russia are absolutely hilarious. And had it been less oppressive, those jokes wouldn't really have made so much sense, right?
Yes. And so your book has been out now for a while. It's doing very well. Are you still getting a lot of the kind of Sonny Huston reaction, or do you feel like you're winning the argument?
I do feel like I'm winning the argument, of, as judged by the majority of onlookers.
Hmm.
Hard for me to gauge that, because I probably get a biased sample of response. But even on The View, the crowd was applauding.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So.
And the rest of the panel actually seemed to be more sympathetic to you than Sonny Huston, I would say.
That's right.
And afterwards, I just want to ask just a bit more about, sorry to obsess about this appearance on The View, but afterwards, was the atmosphere hostile? Was Sonny Huston nice off camera? Was she?
No, she was hostile off camera.
Oh, right.
As well.
Okay.
Very much. Yeah.
Right. So we're down on Sonny. She's not a good thing. Well, Coleman, how do you think this election is going to affect, if we're talking about this, you know, trying to achieve a colorblind America, trying to achieve a colorblind world, do you think this election makes a difference? You, as mentioned in that clip, you're not a Republican, you're not a Trump guy, but clearly the Biden administration is doing a lot of legislation that is neo-racist, I think, by your definition of the term. Do you not think a Republican or getting rid of Joe Biden would be helpful?
Sure, yeah. I'm not a fan of Biden. I voted for him last time as an alternative to Trump. The more and more he looks at the beginnings of senility, the harder and harder it would be to vote for him again. And I think a huge slice of the American public feels that. Mm. Just the way that he talks, or is really unable to talk off the cuff, how few public appearances he has relative to other presidents, and yet still the level and the type of gaffes, the fragility, the memory loss, all of it is very concerning.
Mm.
And has been downplayed. So and you know, that's to say nothing of policy, as you mentioned. Yeah, he absolutely has, on the race issue, has done a lot of policies I disagree with.
Mm.
I'm always open to voting for Republicans.
But let's say you were president for the day. How would you start to undo affirmative action? What actual measures could you take at the federal level that could start to undo a lot of the damage that's been done?
There are several executive orders that could be overturned on day one. Executive orders relating to how to interpret civil rights law.
Mm.
That, for various reasons, even Republican presidents have chosen to not overturn. So that's a signal you could easily send on day one.
Because the reason they haven't is because of a great fear of being seen to be racist.
Probably.
Yeah.
Or that it wasn't actually a high priority for Republican voters, even.
Yes. I think, I mean, do you regard Donald Trump's often called a racist. You're not a Trump fan, as you said. But you don't regard him as a racist.
I've never thought that. I don't think I've ever really thought that he was a racist. I mean, too many of his actions and utterances don't really make sense if he was a racist. I mean, so first of all, his whole pre-presidency of wanting to be as close as possible to the top rappers like P. Diddy and wanting to hang out with them all the time,
yeah,
and be mentioned on their songs and all that, doesn't totally make sense if you're a racist, although, you know, it's not impossible. Mm. The First Step Act, where he basically took he took the policies that the far left wanted to implement in criminal justice reform federally and implemented them straightforwardly, like reduced sentences for drug offenders. Vast majority of the people who benefited from that were Black. Doesn't really make sense if you're a racist president. Making funding for historically Black colleges and universities automatic rather than having to be re-upped every year in Congress doesn't totally make sense if you're a racist president. Had Obama done either of those things, Republicans would have accused him of playing identity politics.
Yes.
So the total package, I have no doubt that Trump has said the N-word or has said racist things. But it's probably of a piece with his general diarrhea of the mouth, rather than some kind of coherent anti-Black philosophy. My sense is that Trump would love nothing more than for Black people en masse to vote for him.
Yes. Well, but I mean, he has grown support among Black people. And one of the reasons people say that is, and this isn't perhaps in itself racist, is that that because he's now on the wrong side of the law, and that Black people are more likely to think if the legal system is against you, they're more likely to sympathise with you. Do you think there's some of that going on, or do you think that's a racist interpretation of what's happening with Trump?
I don't really see evidence that that's the reason. And for instance, it would seem that other Republicans have also, in those same polls, other Republicans are also doing much better against Biden than they were years ago. So it doesn't necessarily seem to be a Trump effect. It seems to be a party effect. Like, people are going from Democrats to Republicans in general, regardless of Trump. On the other hand, I don't think it's a racist explanation. If it were true, I mean, for instance, it does seem to be true that all of Trump's indictments made him more popular with Republicans in general, because the second the indictments hit is when his poll numbers skyrocketed within the Republican Party and he secured the nomination. So if it's possible that the Republican base flocked to him when he started getting indicted, I don't see that it's impossible that Black people could have or some contingent of Black people could have the same reaction. I don't think it's racist. I haven't really seen that that's the best explanation.
Or is it just a class thing, that quite a lot of Black people are working class, and the working class identify with Trump because they find all his pronouncements, you know, he can make some ridiculous ejaculation about, you know, what he thinks, and working class people identify with it for some reason. For some reason, because he's a cultural phenomenon, and that is cross-racial. That's a class thing.
Could be. According to the Pew Research Center, what we know about the Black people that are leaving the Democratic Party and going Republican is that they skew towards Black men under 30, who have the same class background as other Black people, but less racial solidarity and racial identity. So it's pretty much like I'm a pretty good archetype for, well, actually no, because I grew up upper middle class, but if you imagine someone like me that grew up with less privilege, grew up more middle class, lower middle class, that's like the archetype of the person, of the Black person that is moving away from the Democratic Party. So, you know, what explains that? Is it a class thing? I don't know. It could be. Could also just be that the Democratic Party messaging around race, that you are a victim, the system's against you, white supremacy is forever, is actually a turnoff to some especially ambitious young men that would much prefer to be told, your future's in your hands. Get up off your ass and work, make something of yourself, and become great. in some way similar to kind of like why a lot of young men like Jordan Peterson's message.
Yes. But do you think perhaps that's it with among the neo-racists, among the Ibram X. Kendi and so on, it's a raging against the dying of what they see as the light, because the fact is they are in the minority now, and you know, most people are on your side of the argument.
Always has been, though. The only thing is maybe now it's more apparent, but even at the height of his power, to use a strange phrase, you know, most people did not actually agree with Ibram Kendi.
No. Because in many ways he was trolling. I know that's an overused word.
No,
but it was provoking a reaction.
I don't know if he's trolling. I mean, he could have been trolling, but I don't assume that. I assume he's a true believer.
You don't think Robin DiAngelo is sort of flirting with middle-class bourgeois outrage?
It's hard to write a whole book about something you just fundamentally don't actually believe. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just, if you read their books, they seem to put a lot of effort into developing a coherent and insane philosophy. So I assume that they really believe what they say they believe. I mean, if you think about it, people believe crazy things in this world. There are Scientologists that are true believers. There are people that, despite 100 years of evidence, are still dyed-in-the-wool communists and really believe it. So, you know, the simplest explanation is that they really believe in the neo-racism stuff.
Yes. Well, Coleman, I think we better end it there. But thank you very much for coming on to the Americano podcast. It is always a pleasure to have you on.
Good to be on.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Ferrose, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.